Do you want to learn interesting psychological information in an easy, straightforward, and entertaining manner? Then you need to listen to The Shrink Is In, a podcast show produced and hosted by Dr. Howard Gurr. Dr. Gurr is a practicing licensed psychologist for more than 25 years in New York State, and now he is available to you on the internet. Now, here's Dr. Howard Gurr.
Hey, it's Dr. Gurr with another psychological podcast, and if you've listened to my podcast in the past, you can tell that my voice is somewhat deeper than usual, and that means I have a cold. I would love to keep this voice, as I have said before, but it just doesn't work that way, and when I get better, it goes away, and I have my normal voice. Anyway, today, my podcast is, again, somewhat different than usual. Let me give you the history on this. I was contacted by Kirk Honda, who's a licensed therapist in Seattle. He's been practicing since 1996. He has a master's in psychology from Antioch University in Seattle, and he's taught graduate-level psychology courses at Antioch for 9 years, and he's also a supervisor and consultant to other therapists. And Kirk joined the podcast generation, and he has his own podcast called Psychology in Seattle, and the address is www.psychologyinseattle.com. That's psychologyinseattle.com. And Kirk really has a vidcast. It's not a podcast. And it's Kirk and two of his friends, who are not clinicians, by the way. And they talk about psychological issues. And it's a very laid-back, nice kind of show, easy to watch. And Kirk decided, you know, what would happen if the two of us, two clinicians, one from Seattle and one from Long Island, got together and did a podcast show talking about psychological issues and talking about the differences between what we do and the different coasts and mental health. And that's what today's show is all about. It's just Kirk and I talking back and forth. So let's listen now.
So how is mental health out there in Seattle?
Well, in terms of practicing or yeah. In terms of the general feeling of people out here or I don't know. Like I said, I'm born and raised in Seattle, so I don't really know much different. From my understanding, I think I've heard this before, that East Coast compared to West Coast, that West Coast people with master's degrees are more prevalent and perhaps a little bit more respected than people on the East Coast. Do you think that's true? Because I have a master's degree, so I demand respect.
Oh, okay. I would have said that was true, but I think over the last couple of years, master's level people are starting to become more prevalent, and doctoral level people are starting to fade out. Like when I was in graduate school, my program was rather large compared to other graduate schools, but we had like 38 people in my class.
Yeah.
That same school now has 11 people in their class.
Okay.
So I think the number of doctoral students is diminishing, and probably because, you know, people are saying, well, you know, why go through all of that schooling?
Right.
So that's happening. But I think I once read a statistic that 25% of all the psychiatrists are in New York City.
Really?
Yeah. 25% of all the psychiatrists in the United States happen to have their practice in New York City.
Wow.
So, It's probably, you know, if we had to weigh, you know, the balance, probably the country would be tipping, you know, on the East Coast.
Yeah.
there are more. I mean, I looked at the other day. There are, again, Long Island. In the two counties, Nassau and Suffolk County, which make up the island, I think there were 1,100 psychologists in Nassau County and 850 in Suffolk County. And that's just psychologists. So I'm not counting social workers, art therapists, marriage and family therapists. I mean, there's all sorts of therapists and psychologists here. So yeah. Per capita, I think we probably have, you know, more therapists than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, I would say that's a difference from out here in Seattle. I would say that there are pockets of that culture of people who appreciate therapy in that way. Mm-hmm. And I certainly have clients like that. But I would say that they're a minority among shall we call them regular Americans that are afraid of therapy or have a stigma about going to therapy, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't think the stigma is here. Now, as I said, I live in a very, you know, I guess unique area. But I would think, you know, probably Boston and Long Island and, you know, other areas probably are similar. Anyway, so I think that's the difference between the East and the West Coast. I think it's a mindset piece.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that even certain ethnic groups are more likely to appreciate and use therapy well.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent. I think it's probably not so much ethnic groups. I think from my experience, I think it's educational level.
Yeah, perhaps.
And what I find is that the more educated and more sophisticated people are, the less they seem threatened by therapy and counseling.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like this alien concept to them. It's not unknown. They tend to search out enlightenment and they want to learn. And I think that they see therapy as a learning process.
Right.
And I think people who are less educated may see it as something that's, you know, maybe from them, from their perspective, taking control away from them.
Yeah, and maybe to add to that, they might see us as authority, and they might not have the best experiences with authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
they might get treated poorly by people who talk like us, you know.
Yeah, people who in their minds think that they're better than they are.
Right.
Because
being in therapy to a certain extent is they're coming to us for help and we give them help. Mm-hmm. And if they've been told they need help from authority and from official sorts of people in an insulting way, they might sort of project that onto us.
Well, you know, if they're captives. You know, like people who are sent to therapy through court systems,
right?
Or you know, spousal abuse cases, or you know, domestic violence cases. Yeah, those people are generally unhappy and angry because they feel like they're being, in a sense, put in a position where, you know, they're parented again and told how wrong they are. And there's a gun to the back of their head for the most part, because right. If they don't follow through, then there's a possibility of some major repercussions.
Yeah. Do you have court-ordered patients?
No. When I first started out, I actually – my training was – my early internship training was in the prison for the criminally insane in upstate New York. It's called Fishkill Correctional Facility.
Fishkill?
Fishkill, yeah.
Fishkill.
Yes, that's what it's called, yes. That's what it's called. In Beacon, New York. Okay. And so when I graduated and started my practice, I would get a lot of cases from defense attorneys because they knew what my background was. And so I had a lot of cases of, you know, kind of interesting cases, you know.
Yeah, I'll say.
And some of them, you know, like I had, a, you know, a couple of cases that were in the Enquirer.
Really?
Yeah, which I can't talk about. But weird cases. But, you know, as my practice developed and as I kind of moved on and got married and had kids, I kind of decided it was a little bit more uncertain and unsettling to have these people in my office. Although I could control them, I think my family was a little afraid of them.
You were never threatened? You never felt afraid?
No. No. I mean, not in my practice. And when I was in the prison system, interesting enough, the week before I got there, one psychologist was murdered. But that psychologist had made a grievous error. And she had believed this guy and made some arrangements and had him transferred to a halfway house and was still connected to him. And he was in for murder one, and he wound up murdering her. So, you know, that was a little scary.
So she made a mistake because she allowed him to know her personal information?
She got connected to him. She was more involved with him than she should have. You know, when you're working with inmates, you know, one of the things you learn right away is to keep your distance and not kind of get sucked in by their, you know, their games or their manipulations.
Right. Well, we shouldn't in any practice, we shouldn't let that. But are you saying that she let – they had an outside relationship from the therapy?
Yeah, she got involved. Yeah. And then one day when I went to work, apparently one of the inmates had somebody smuggle in LSD. And it was put into the staff's coffee.
Oh, my God.
And I did not drink coffee. And so I was pretty straight. But, you know, it was bad to see them, you know, carry, you know, these, you know, old secretaries out on stretchers, because they were all hallucinating. So you had to be very careful, and, you know, you had to know what you were doing with these people. Wow. And my internship was in a clinic. I was in what was called D&E, or Diagnostic and Evaluation. And I had 30 days to determine whether someone was truly psychotic and needed to be in a psychiatric facility, or they were doing something we call bagging it, which was faking crazy in order to get out of maximum security. Because if you know, you had a life sentence and you were going to be in jail for, you know, 50 years, you had a choice between being in a maximum security prison or, you know, being in a psychiatric hospital. Not that you were with great people, but you could, you know, read magazines, watch TV, and hang out all day.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, being locked in a cell for 23 hours and you only have 1 hour for, you know, R&R. So a lot of guys were faking crazy to get out of maximum security, and it was our job to determine who was legitimately psychotic and needed to stay and who needed to be sent back. I had to pretend in the prison to be something I really wasn't. And I grew up in New York City in Queens, and I worked as a construction worker to pay for undergraduate school. So I had a kind of hardness I could put on when I needed it. And with the inmates, since I only had 30 days, I would spend the first session looking at their rap sheet, and then probably putting on this act of, you know, I'm tougher than you, and here's how I would have done your crime, and if you did it my way, you wouldn't be in prison. And so I would go through this whole routine with their crime step by step and improving upon it. And they would look at me – well, if they looked at me like, oh, my God, you're nuts, then I knew I had a chance that this guy was not psychotic. The psychotics wouldn't even really acknowledge that. They would just, you know, sit there. So my first bit was to kind of out-crazy them and see if I could, you know, kind of unsettle them a bit. And so it was this whole act I would go through. And, you know, I would do this, you know, tough guy act with them. And it's interesting because my supervisor who was there was a guy who had a scar running across the length of his forehead. This guy Mike, and Mike Bocci was his name. And so between the two of us, we looked like, you know, we were just as scary as they were. Kirk, you're a marriage and family therapist. Is that what you do full time?
Yeah, that's what I do. That's all I do. Just my private practice. I used to teach for 9 years, graduate level psychology courses, but I quit that because I wanted to concentrate on my practice more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see about half my practice are adults, single, you know, individual adults, and the other half are teenagers and families.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have a preference?
No, like you, I like a variety. I like to see lots of different sorts of people. And since people don't think of me as specializing in one thing, I think I get a lot of, various different issues that people come to me for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I like to look up, you know, if there's a new area that I don't know much about, I like to do a lot of research and ask other clinicians about what they would do. And it's that academic and that learning part of it is very exciting for me. So I have a question for you.
Okay.
There's sort of a preamble to it. Earlier in December 2008, I had an episode on alcoholism and addiction, where I interviewed a friend about a lifelong his lifelong struggle with substances. He'd been an addict for many years, and he talked about how he regretted many things that he did during the during that time. He had committed violent crimes, or he had mugged people. He had ruined a lot of his relationships. He endangered his own life. He'd been in the hospital. Doctor said, he, you know, if he doesn't stop drinking, he's going to die. He's, you know, a severe addict and alcoholic. He's since recovered, but, you know, and now he's doing well. So I had him on the episode. And as we were talking, I said something along the lines of to him, I said, some people say that some people experience a euphoric high from using substances and are therefore susceptible to developing addiction, whereas others who don't have the disposition to addiction or the addiction gene, those people can take it or leave it. And I asked him, what would you say about that? So that's part of the episode that, you know, went up on I also have my podcast on YouTube. And a person who was watching on YouTube responded. They said, oh, no, the addiction gene. Really, Kirk, what is your evidence for the existence of a gene that makes people predisposed to addiction? This is pure fantasy. This is that's what the person said. So, Howie, what do you think? Did I make an error in saying the word gene?
Well, my belief is that there probably will be some finding that there is a genetic predisposition only because the statistics support it. If in fact you have two parents, I believe, who are or have had substance issues, you have a 68% chance of having a substance issue yourself.
But people would say that that might just be because of environment, right?
Yeah, but you know what? I'm going to refute that too, because I will tell you, and I have classic examples of that. For example, I've had cases where parents, both parents, did not have a substance issue, and the adolescent did. And when I speak to the adolescent, I would say, well, who has a substance issue in your family? And the kid would say, nobody. I'm the only one. And I would say, I tend to doubt that. Go check. And they'd come back and say, well, you know, I spoke to my parents, and it turns out that my grandparents had substance problems for most of their lives. They don't now, but they did for most of their lives. And what had happened was is the parents, in dealing and living with this of their own parents who had substance issues, they decided to become abstinent. So they had no substance issues in the household at all. The kid wasn't prepared to know that they might have had that potential because they didn't see anything.
Right.
So I still
I think they've also done twin studies, you know, where the twins are separated at birth, and or kids are separated, adoption studies where kids are separated from birth. So they're not and they're not raised in a substance abuse environment. And since their parents had addictions, they were much more likely to develop an addiction or a problem with substances.
Right. And I think the gene is not necessarily that you have an addiction. I think the gene potential is such that something isn't breaking down properly or something isn't working properly. And that allows somebody to have – or predisposes someone to have a substance issue. You know, a lot of those twin studies, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I guess my training was such that environment was the major factor in causing people to become who they are.
Yeah.
But over years of doing this, I've come to believe that that's not necessarily true. And
yeah,
that
the same way.
Environment has maybe a 20-30% influence of who we are, and the packaging that we came with has about a 70% influence about who we are. And the turning point was, for me, those twin studies, where they separated these kids at birth because they were at orphanages, and they didn't tell the adoptive parents that their adoptive child was a twin.
Right.
And then they followed them.
Right.
And you could see the similarities in these kids. And interestingly enough, there was a story years ago, many years ago, here, where one kid had gone to he went to a community college upstate New York, Sullivan County Community College. That's what it was. And he was there for a year and then left. And the next year, another kid showed up, and everyone in the college thought it was the first kid, but it wasn't. It was another kid who was identical to the first kid. And the, you know, it hit the papers that there was this kid and this situation with the twins. It turns out that there was a third one. They were triplets. And the third one saw the newspaper ad, the newspaper article, and he went up there, and now these three brothers met. And the three of them actually opened up a restaurant.
No, really?
Yeah. I think they called it Trio in New York City. And it turns out that the similarities between the boys was incredible.
Yeah.
And I met them once, and I couldn't tell the difference between the three boys. But in terms of their personalities and likes and dislikes, they were very identical. So I think the reality is that genetics does play a significant part. But I think that when people hear that, they get upset because they believe that it's a sense of I'm predestined. Right. I have no control and I have no power over this, that I'm predestined to have a problem and I can't do anything about it.
Right.
You know, do you remember Jim Fix? I don't know if you know who he is.
No.
Jim Fix was the guy who was very key in producing the New York City Marathon.
Yeah,
and it turned out that Jim Fix, at the age of 20 or 22, I believe, his father, who was 42 at the time, passed away from a sudden and massive coronary. Mm. Jim Fix freaked out about that and became a marathon runner.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Fix died of a massive coronary at 45.
Yeah.
And so as much as he tried to kind of undermine and beat the system, his genetics got the better of him anyway.
Right.
So I see tons and tons of examples of genetic issues out there, and substance issues are just one of them to me.
Yeah, and in personality, I think anyone who has seen an infant grow into early childhood and into adolescence and into adulthood, you can see definite foundations in their personality that they came into this world with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, so getting back to this comment that this person says, and you know, it says, really, Kirk, what is your evidence for the existence of a gene that makes people predisposed to addiction? This is pure fantasy. Well, I'm not a researcher. I'm a therapist, and I read a lot of, you know, literature. And I don't have it at the tip of, you know, I don't have it on hand right now, but, you know, we can both, you know, we've both read a lot of literature that points towards evidence that genetics does play a part in having people having a disposition to being susceptible to addiction. It doesn't mean that they're going to be an addict if both their parents are addicts.
Exactly.
It just means that, you know, just, they're susceptible. I mean, the bottom line is that we all have free will to use drugs or not. But some of us are more likely to be susceptible to addiction. And the thing that I found, and you know, the reason why I even brought it up in this interview with this person was that I found that people that are susceptible have the, you know, so-called addiction gene, is that when they use, they feel so good. It's like they've never felt that good in their life. And whereas some people, the first time they use a substance, they might get a little high, a little loaded, but they might either be neutral or not like it at all. If you love that feeling, that high, then you know, you're going to be motivated to recreate that feeling.
You know, I'm not sure I would see it that way. I think that no matter what substance you use, the first time, like even when you speak to people who are cocaine abusers, that first high is incredible.
Yeah.
And the problem is that no subsequent high ever matches that original high,
right?
Because at that particular point, I think there's already damage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what's happened is that the nerve receptors in that particular area of the brain that respond, you've already burned some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could never replicate that level of high.
Mm-hmm.
And the neurotransmitters don't work as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the difference is, I think everyone would probably experience that same high, but I think someone who's got a substance issue is driven to replicate it over and over and over again. And they're looking for it over and over and over again, and they never seem to achieve it. And but I think that, again, the high is the high is the high, because the substance is this, it's the same thing. But I think that some people are driven to you know, reach that high again. Same thing with people who are self-injurious. You know, I mean, you think, well, you know, why would someone be a cutter? Why would someone harm themselves? And I think that because there's some release of some neurotransmitters that makes them feel good for a second and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll tell you that I felt good for a second and a half, but they're driven to do it over and over and over again because they're looking for that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could cut myself. I'm not exactly looking to do it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would avoid it if I could.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not looking for that experience.
Right, so, but might some people have the disposition, the genetics, or you know, the biological disposition to experience much more enjoyment from a particular kind of high than someone else? For instance, when I was in college, you know, in my bachelor's at University of Washington. There were people who – everyone drank, it seemed. Everyone drank a lot of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And but there were some people that didn't. I remember finding them to be very – they were very anomalous and unusual. And when I look back on their description of their experience with alcohol, it was almost entirely negative. I mean, they had all the experiences that anyone would experience from drinking alcohol, but they didn't like it. It just didn't agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could see – how a person like that, you know, maybe based on their biology, it would seem so, that it would be very difficult for them to develop an addiction to alcohol if they didn't like the feeling of being drunk. Whereas someone else who has, say, the disposition to very much enjoy, say, I mean, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I'm just guessing that some people have a biology to have a dopamine released more than, or maybe they're more susceptible to the release of dopamine when drinking alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone else might not. So although the high might be the same, the susceptibility to or the feeling or the euphoria that one feels when intoxicated might be different between two different people.
It's possible. You know, I don't know well enough if that's, you know, your theory is correct or not. But, you know, it has some plausibility to it.
Yeah.
But
we should get a neuroscientist on the show and.
Yeah.
Find out what the latest research is on that. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's possible. It's an issue that, you know, I don't really have a definitive answer, but, you know, it logically, you know, it makes sense that, you know, these are the things that are going on.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, I have another question for you.
Okay.
So in January earlier this year, I had an episode on sexual addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a number of people come to me for a sexual addiction. Either they're the sexual addict or they're a loved one of a sexual addict.
Right.
I didn't go in the episode. I didn't go into depth on the subject too much because it's a broad subject. But I mainly focused on how we might define or identify sexual addiction versus just interesting sexual behavior. Because
mm-hmm.
I find that most people, when they talk about sexual addiction, they apply it much more liberally than I think is what clinicians would.
Mm-hmm.
So I defined different scenarios, and I had my co-hosts, I had them try to decipher whether or not it was a sexual addiction or not. So for instance, I had an example of a man masturbates in his office at work. he gets caught and he loses his job, mm-hmm. is he a sexual addict? Well, under certain definitions, he had a major consequence as a result of a sexual behavior, so he might, you know, he might have a problem, but you know, it's sort of a gray area there because he might have just, I don't know, there's a debate there, and you'd have to get to know that person a little bit more to find out if it was compulsive and there were other behaviors that he did in addition to that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people would say, if just hearing that story, would say, oh, he's a sex addict. You know, I think a lay person might just label him as a sex addict just based on that information. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Another example that I hear a lot of is a wife catches her husband masturbating while looking at lewd porn on the internet. Mm-hmm. She's upset and threatens to divorce him if he does it again because she, for moral reasons or personal reasons, she doesn't like pornography. He tries to resist the urge, but he does it again, gets caught, and then they divorce or they break up, or at least they go through a very rocky time.
Right.
You know, is he a sex addict? You know, so there we have more of a pattern.
Right. Right.
Of doing it. He's, you know, he clearly is risking his marriage and he doesn't want to do that.
It's more compulsive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, without getting to know the guy, you don't necessarily know if it's compulsive or not. I mean, maybe he just considers pornography and masturbation a part of his life and, you know, it's like fishing to him. You know, he just really likes to do it, and he doesn't want to be told not to do it, you know. So whereas it could be an actual compulsion as well, but you would have to talk with him and find out what was behind his motivation for doing that.
Well, I think this simple definition is if a behavior like a sexual behavior intrudes upon your life to the point where it is damaging to your either your social, professional, or personal existence, and it's not something that you could stop without help, then it's an addiction.
Right, and that'll catch a lot of the examples. But you know, as another example, you could say, well, what if it was fishing? You know, what if his wife hated him fishing all the time because it took him away from the family.
Mm-hmm.
And he just loved to fish. He loved the outdoors. He loved the rivers. He loved all that stuff. And it ended up ruining his marriage or maybe even his job. You know, would he be addicted to fishing?
Yeah. In my book, he would be.
Okay.
Because again, it would be a situation whereby an activity, that could be held in moderation got to the point where it intruded in his life significantly enough that it caused damage. I mean, if
right,
you're going to throw your marriage away over fishing, you know, either A, you wanted to get rid of the marriage and therefore you just, you know, knew that that would be enough to push your wife over the edge, or you couldn't help yourself.
Right. What, right. And if he couldn't help it, then that's in the addiction,
right?
Down the addiction road. But maybe it's just bad decision making. You know, I mean, maybe he just isn't making good choices, and that's not addiction. People make bad choices all the time,
right?
So anyway, I gave that's basically the discussion that we had, and so someone wrote in, mm-hmm. Again on YouTube, and they say, apart from physical dependency, which would apply to say drink or drugs, how can this apply to sex?
Yeah.
Of course, you could consider it a form of repetition compulsion, which is not classical addiction. So what do you think about this comment, Howie?
You know, I think addiction can be used a little looser than I guess this person believes. You know, for example, I had a guy who would not see it as a problem to lose $100,000 in a weekend gambling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, he only decided he had a problem the weekend he lost $250,000.
Right.
But you know, there's not, I mean, on some level there is some physical piece to gambling.
Right.
But to me that man was addicted.
Right.
So I think that, you know, you could be addicted to something that is not a substance or something that is something that you take in on some level, You know, there are people out there who are addicted to exercise, mm-hmm. you know, in moderation.
Well, so how would we define someone who's addicted to exercise versus someone who just exercises a lot? What's the difference between those two people?
I think, again, the reason the demarcation line for me is the concept of damage.
Yeah.
When you're exercising to the point where you're actually causing damage, mm-hmm. Then you have a problem.
Could we further that and say they know that it's incurring damage?
Well, they may not.
Right. But say they exercise a lot and they're developing some kind of internal problem that mm-hmm. they know of. They, you know, some kind of, I don't know, like a stomach problem. And the, you know, the exercise is causing the stomach problem, but they don't know that.
Well, I'm talking about the person who might be on a treadmill for 3 hours in the morning.
Yeah.
And then 3 hours at night. Meanwhile, during the rest of the day, they're exercising as much as they can. And instead of actually building up, they're really burning up muscle tissue.
Yeah.
Because they're getting too skinny or you know, it's almost on the verge of anorexia. You know, there are all sorts of ways to look at exercise. And to me, you could be doing something that's you know, again, you know, gambling is okay in moderation. Sex is okay in moderation. Everything's okay in moderation.
Yeah.
But if something is taken to the point where it is now causing harm, I think, and the person can't stop, then to me it's crossed into an addiction.
Right. And I think that's the key, is that the person can't stop and they're trying to stop, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. When it becomes an addiction for me.
And I think that when you've damaged a marriage, lost a job, I think you carefully have to look at, you know, yes, you know, the judgment could be there, but then you have to look at, is the behavior itself addicting? And an addictive behavior is one, I think, somehow where there is a payoff. I mean, someone is getting something that they need from it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it.
Right.
But the question is, what are they getting? And is there another way to get that in a more healthy manner?
Right. So getting back to his comment, the person who wrote in, they say, I think they're essentially saying that we can't call sexual addiction addiction because it's not a physical dependency.
Well,
I
disagree.
Yeah.
I think because what this person is missing is, and again, we have to go back to the core. We're talking about, you know, electrobiochemistry here. We're talking about neurotransmitters. And
yeah.
Even with a substance, we're still talking about transmitters. Neurotransmitters and altering our brain biochemistry.
Right.
And so to me, sex addiction is only altering this individual's brain biochemistry.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
right.
You know, we tend to forget certain things, you know, like pasta. You know, people go for what we call comfort foods when they're upset. But we also know that comfort foods raise serotonin levels. And albeit, you know, small amounts. But clearly it's changing brain biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So could eating pasta be an addiction? The answer is yes. I was never a cigarette smoker. I never understood cigarette smoking. I thought it was a ridiculous habit. And I really thought that, you know, nicotine is just a stimulant. I mean, you know, that's all it is. If you look at it biochemically, it's a stimulant. And so I never understood why my patients would say, well, I needed a cigarette and it kind of calmed me down.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking, why would it calm you down? It shouldn't calm you down. It should get you kind of stimulated. Until we found, again, through research, that nicotine raises dopamine levels.
Uh-huh.
And so now it makes perfect sense to me that when you smoke a cigarette and you increase your dopamine level, it eliminates or reduces kind of tremors and shakes, which is why we found Parkinson's patients were pretty big cigarette smokers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are all sorts of things in our world that we kind of take for granted, but may very well alter our biochemistry, and therefore there is a physical change.
Right. Yep. But I think in, you know, what this person is writing in is saying is, you know, and you sort of touched on this from the start, was that his definition of addiction is narrow. more narrow than, say, your definition of addiction. And right. it's just semantics at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you call it a problem? Say maybe you call it a sexual problem or a sexual compulsion, or, you know, there's lots of words that we throw out there. And I find that with my podcast, when people write in, that I would say about half the people that have a problem with what I'm saying, it's usually hung up on semantics. Do you get people writing into you saying similar kinds of complaints?
I get comments, criticisms or compliments, it's one or the other.
Yeah. But do they get hung up on semantics? Like you said something and it wasn't really what you meant exactly?
No. What I find is that they either agree with me or disagree with the whole concept.
Yeah.
And for the most part, you know, I kind of try to answer them as well as I can, but yeah, you know, some of them are just kind of a little off base. You don't really know who's listening. You know, it's just, you know, people with, you know, sometimes they have their own, you know, their own agendas or their own issues that kind of leak into their answers. But I find that, you know, if someone asks a question or answer or writes in, it's because you hit something personally with them.
Right.
And they either, you know, want to agree or dispute it or they want to argue the point. You know, that you're wrong or you're right, whatever. But, you know, you hit something personal.
Yeah. Right. And it compels them to write in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find that there are some things that people write in more about that it tends to strike them personally more often than other subjects?
You know, my shows are a little different than yours. And for the most part, you know, either I'm interviewing somebody else who really has, you know, their own product, book, or program that they're promoting, or it's some offbeat, ridiculous little psychological topic that I just, you know, it kind of caught my fancy and I decided to throw out there. So most of them are not, you know, controversial. Although I did one on Stanley Milgram's research recently. That I got responses on, and it was on that whole, you know, following authority and doing things that might be terrible to other human beings because you acquiesce to an authority. And so I got responses on that people were either interested or upset with that, you know, because I basically was talking about how, you know, human beings could do terrible things to other human beings if in fact they felt that they were forced to by an outside authority,
right.
You know, and that, you know, it's not that, you know, people who are horrible to other human beings are horrible human beings. Anybody, any average individual, could be turned into that.
Right.
And I think that was a little unsettling to people.
Unsettling because they thought you were talking about them directly, or it was unsettling to think that humans in general could be capable of that?
I think the second. I think that they wanted to believe that people who were you know, the Nazi SS soldiers and people who torture other people must be monsters. They must be terrible, horrible people. And research suggests that that's not true, that any average individual can be turned into someone who would perform the same atrocities. And I think that individuals just couldn't handle the fact that – does that mean that I too could possibly do that? And the answer is yes.
Right. And so for you to compare them to a Nazi torturer,
yeah,
they probably might, you know, get a little prickly about that.
Right. And I think that the bottom line is that human beings are human beings, and we're all capable of doing terrible things under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
But, you know, nobody really wants to know that they could be one of those people. Anyway, Kirk, I got to go.
Okay.
Anyway, it's been great talking to you. We should do this again.
Yeah. Okay? Great. Thanks, Howie.
Good talking to you. Okay.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye.
Take it easy, Kirk.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gerr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gerr, go to his website at www.drsgurr.com.